Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for October of 2018. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be interesting to everyone. The calendar for October shows that Yom Kippur is on the 8th. The United States Navy was established on the 13th of 1776-75, and Columbus Day is observed on the 14th. We celebrate Halloween on the 31st with all of the trick-or-treaters. October is also Breast Cancer Awareness Month and National Apple Month. In recent years, the alternatives to conventional cow's milk have proliferated. Your local supermarket is likely to offer any number of plant-based options. Milk made from soy, almonds, oats, rice, hemp, coconuts, cashew, pea plants, and more. But most non-dairy milk pales in comparison to cow's milk. Plant-based milks are made by breaking down plants and reconstituting their proteins in water to resemble the fluid from a milking cow. These proteins differ fundamentally from true dairy proteins, and the results, milk, yogurt, and cheese in name only, often fail to measure up in color, taste, or texture. Inge Radman, a molecular biologist and a founder of New Culture, a food company, puts it plainly. Vegan cheese is just terrible, she says. As scientists, we know why it doesn't work. It doesn't have the critical dairy proteins. Dairy tastes like dairy thanks to two key proteins, casein and whey proteins. Researchers at several startup companies, including New Culture, have been producing these proteins in the lab with the aim of creating a new grocery store category of cow-free dairy products. Their process is loosely comparable to the way Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat makes meatless burgers. Microbes, such as yeast, are given the genetic instruction to produce the dairy proteins. The microbes are then cultivated en masse with nutrients added and temperatures adjusted. Eventually, the organisms start churning out large quantities of the proteins, and these are isolated and added to various recipes. For the Impossible Burger, the essential protein is a molecule called heme, which is abundant in animal muscles and gives the burger its meaty flavor and even makes it seem to bleed. New Culture is focusing on producing casein, a protein that coagulates to give mozzarella cheese its stretchy texture. Ms. Radman says the company has conducted double-blind tests to see if people could tell the difference between the proof of concept cheese and the store-bought mozzarella. We've had really positive results, she said. The quest for cow-free dairy is expanding. In Oakland, California, scientists at a community science lab are trying to make their own open-source recipe for lab-made cheese, and a startup in Boston called Motif Ingredients is engineering a variety of proteins from dairy, eggs, and meat. Another company, Perfect Day, may be the furthest along in perfecting a recipe for lab-made dairy products. The company produces whey protein and mixes them with other ingredients found in traditional dairy products, fats, carbohydrates, calcium, and phosphates. In early July, a limited edition batch was released with flavors including chocolate, vanilla salted fudge, and vanilla blackberry toffee. It sold out quickly. Hundreds of thousands of metric tons of whey and casein are consumed in the United States each year, virtually all of it produced by dairy farms. Proponents of lab-made milk see the product appealing to dairy food lovers broadly while satisfying concerns about animal waste and environmental sustainability. But to make a real impact on the planet and eliminate the carbon emissions from all these belching cows, a great many microbes will be needed to be corralled. The challenge is scaling up. Perfect Day plans to sell its lab-made whey to ice cream makers, dairy companies, and restaurants rather than directly to consumers. It is partnered with the agricultural giant Archer Daniels Midland with its industrial-scale fermentation infrastructure to try to meet market demand and reduce the cost of producing proteins. That's what the two of us spend most of our time on, said Permal Gandhi, a founder of Perfect Day. Sure, we have ADM, but even if we max them out, it's still just a drop in the bucket. There's already stiff competition from plant-made dairy alternatives, which offer similar environmental benefits and have gained popularity among consumers. Sales of plant-based milks jumped 6% last year and now make up to 13% of the entire milk category, according to data from the Plant-Based Foods Association and the Good Food Institute. Sales of plant-based ice cream and frozen desserts grew 27%, plant-based cheese grew 19%, and plant-based yogurt grew 39%. All of a sudden, people are realizing they don't have to depend on cows for milk, said Cheryl Mitchell, head of research and development at Elmhurst Milk, one of New York's largest dairy companies, which switched to making nut milks in 2016. Technology has also improved the taste of plant-based milks and decreased the amount of water needed to produce several of them. We want to be increasing our agricultural diversity to help environmental sustainability, but not just relying on one source, Mitchell said. Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger have been popular with consumers. Whether lab-made milk can replicate that success is an open question. Have you tried any of these plant-based milks? In previous programs, we've introduced you to Bea Wilson, who writes a food column for the Wall Street Journal called Table Talk. In late July, she wrote an article titled, Deliciousness is What Matters Most. And here's what she said. In the modern world, you can tie yourself in knots deciding what to eat. Is this food ethical enough? Is it high in protein? Is it locally grown? With so many competing voices shouting in your head, you could almost forget to check whether the darn thing tastes any good. She continues, I recently visited an exhibit in London devoted to the future of food called Food Bigger Than the Plate. Each room contained ingenious visions of reinventing how and what we should eat. Will we embrace a sustainable form of salami made from insects, an ingredient some chefs tout as a protein of the future? Will mushrooms be grown and used coffee grounds, a plentiful bed of nutrients that's normally thrown away? In the final room, you could order from a futuristic food lab. And at a counter, you tick three criteria for a great food system, and the chefs prepared a snack accordingly. You can choose from attributes that included wild, vegan, cutting edge, open source, traditional, and zero waste. After much agonizing, I went for a snack that would combine delicious, nutritious, and biodiverse. They handed me a chia seed cracker topped with foraged mushroom spread for biodiversity, fish dust for a nutrient boost, and local sheep's milk cheese plus a relish made from tomatoes too ugly for the supermarket. It had a rich, tangy flavor from the sheep's milk cheese and the relish, which I assume were meant to be the delicious elements of the snack. At any rate, they were the most delicious to me. I was glad when I put deliciousness first. The chefs behind the counter told me that almost everyone walking around the exhibit made the same choice. But in a sense, it was all a trick. The chef told me they designed everything on the menu to fit the delicious category on the understanding that few human beings in their right minds are eager to eat something that's described as less than delicious. For all our modern food questions, delicious still wins. Sustainable matters for sure, but what really speaks to us most about food remains the pleasure it gives us. It's a shame that we spend so much of our lives denying this simple truth. You'll meet people, many of them are consumers of protein shakes, who claim to believe that flavor is nothing more than a distraction from the real purpose of food, which is fuel. This attitude is a throwback to the Victorian temperance of the past, when plain was a form of approval for cookery writers. John Henry Kellogg, who invented cornflakes in the late 19th century, was convinced that Americans would be led into sin if they consumed anything too flavorful. Cornflakes were purposely designed to be deeply planned in order not to overstimulate eaters at breakfast. Temperance may be behind us, but we still have a moralizing food culture that encourages us to mistrust our own pleasure at the table. Packaged snacks are advertised as guilt-free, as if every moment of pleasure requires atonement. Many are convinced that the obesity crisis is caused by people taking too much enjoyment in food, but no one who has ever endured binge eating, and I include myself, would describe that compulsion as a pleasure. When you truly savor food, sometimes it can be hard for us to allow ourselves to do. It's easier to eat less. This may sound counterintuitive, but research suggests that taking time to focus on pleasure can actually make diners content with smaller portions. A couple of years ago, I met a French consumer scientist named Pierre Chandon. He had done 5 experiments asking adults and small children in the U.S. and France to vividly imagine the taste, the smell, the texture of a particular food before choosing a portion of it. Compared with the control group, those who had focused their mind on how delicious the food was were happy with a smaller portion of it. That is not to say that delicious is in any way an objective category. There's no such thing as a universal human taste, except perhaps for mother's milk we drank as babies. And ideas about what is delicious have varied hugely across time and place. Generations ago in Japan, pork was seen as disgusting foreign food, but is now the most consumed meat in the country and the foundation of countless delicious dishes from ramen noodle soup to pork katsu curry. Modern ideas of what is delicious are much more homogeneous, however, than in the past. This is because so many of our tastes have been formed or malformed by the junk food industry. We have been sold the notion that a food must be high in sugar and or fat and salt, and maybe all 3 at once. As the journalist Michael Moss exposed in his 2013 book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, Food Company Engineers Treat with a Chemically Calculated Bliss Point Designed to Get Us Hooked. What interests me is not that everyone gets hooked on these products. One of the biggest fallacies about food is that something delicious cannot be healthy, and by implication that anything healthy cannot be delicious. But the signs are that the human quest for better flavor can lead us to better nutrition if we get back to the basics. Taste is a true teller, writes Chef Dan Barber in his 2015 book, The Third Plate. Mr. Barber argues that if we approach the question of taste via vegetables and grains rather than packaged foods, great flavor and nutrition are natural companions rather than adversaries. A deep, flavorful carrot grown in well-mineralized soil is richer in vitamins and minerals than a blender carrot. His point is that, at least in raw ingredients, deliciousness is a signal that good things are happening at the level of nutrients. For too long, we've acted as if delicious food belongs only to the purveyors of soda and chips, but it's perfectly possible to find delight in the snap of a summer radish or sweet charred kernels of a barbecued ear of corn. The problem is that these items tend to be pricier and less convenient to prepare than a bag of cookies. In an uncertain future, many things about our food will need to be redesigned. The London exhibit makes the case that the way we currently farm and eat cannot hold for much longer, either for the environment or for the human health. As an effect of climate change escalate, we may need to harvest new ingredients and cook them in new ways. But these new foods will only be eaten if enough of us believe that they're also delicious. We often find stories of folks who had misfortune but didn't let it overcome them, such as the account of Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen in Chapel Hill. The biscuit-making landmark suffered a fire on June 21st and was closed for over a month. Owner David Allen hoped to be able to reopen by mid-July. Sunrise was closed at the time of the fire, its power having been knocked out from a strong storm in Chapel Hill the night before. A tree had knocked down by the wind, Mr. Allen said, breaking a power line. As the line was being repaired the next day, there was an electrical surge which caused the panel box and Sunrise to catch fire. The fire itself was relatively minor because of the quick action from the electrical workers. A lineman saw the smoke and called 911, Mr. Allen said. No one was in the building at the time. We'd left that morning because there was no power and the staff had left. Allen said the 5,000-square-foot building needed to be rewired and the restaurant's computer system. Multiple refrigerators and the heating and cooling system had to be replaced. We were motivated to be back in business as quickly as possible, he said. This is the second fire in Sunrise's history, the first occurring at the original location in Henderson in 1977. That one was also an electrical fire, but somehow it ended up being a boon for the business. The fire led to a surprising kind of advertising. We were only open a month and really struggling. No one knew what a breakfast was, Mr. Allen said. Then one day there were flames coming out of the top of the roof. The fire department was next door, so they reacted quickly, but ended up on the front page of the local newspaper. And after that, sales were good. Everyone knew where we were, Mr. Allen said. This is a good time to be closed, as is their slowest time of the year. We admire all folks who don't let a big disappointment get them down. Congratulations, Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen. The North Carolina Museum of History's newest restaurant has a pedigree directly to Southern food royalty. Tanya Consul, granddaughter of the late Mildred Mama Dip Consul, had opened Sweet Tea and Cornbread Grill and Eatery in the North Carolina Museum of History. The new restaurant offers museum visitors a weekly lunch option steeped in North Carolina's food history, plus crowd-pleasing options like chicken salad and French fries. I'm thrilled to open the Sweet Tea and Cornbread Grill and Eatery at the North Carolina Museum of History, Ms. Consul said in a press release. I grew up surrounded by classic Southern food, so the museum is a perfect place to both continue that legacy while exploring new modern version of my family's signature dishes. The new restaurant replaces longtime museum's Pharaoh's, which closed last year. Diners will find similar menu items such as hot dogs and sandwiches, but there's a distinctly Southern theme. Look for a country fried steak sandwich, fried green tomatoes, fresh salads and burgers. Daily specials will showcase Council's version of Southern classics and, given the name, bet on Sweet Tea and Cornbread as daily standbys. Like others in the family, Miss Council has followed in the steps of her grandmother, Mama Dip, waiting tables as a teenager at the family restaurant, then starting Tanya's Cookies in Chapel Hill, then recently opened the first Sweet Tea and Cornbread in Crabtree Valley Mall, selling packaged gourmet foods. Mama Dip died in 2018, but her legacy lives on in her namesake restaurant, Mama Dip's in Chapel Hill, which is now operated by her daughters. The new Sweet Tea and Cornbread is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and we wish Tanya continued success in this venture. At least 1 million children and adults are allergic to sesame, an ingredient used in everything from hummus to snack bars, researchers have reported. The findings indicate that the sesame allergy is more prevalent than previously known, although still far less common than peanut allergy. But sesame is not among the allergens that the Food and Drug Administration require manufacturers to list on food labels. Sesame allergy is becoming a common allergy in the United States, says Dr. Ruchi S. Gupta, a professor of pediatrics at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago and senior author of the study, which was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The impact in over 1 million people in the United States is significant. The study relied on online and phone surveys responses from 40,453 adults and 38,408 children. People who had at least one symptom of sesame allergy make up an estimated 0.23% of the population. Gupta and her colleagues found those who have been diagnosed with the allergy but have never experienced the symptom account for 0.11% of the population. That's about 1.1 million people in the United States who currently probably have a sesame allergy and therefore are avoiding sesame in their daily lives, said Christopher M. Warren, an epidemiologist at the Northwest Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research. Exposure to a food allergen like sesame can lead to an aphthalmic reaction, including throat swelling and a drop in blood pressure. Severe reactions can be fatal. Many people in the survey reported symptoms of sesame reaction but were never actually diagnosed, Dr. Gupta noted. If you eat a food and have a reaction, it is important to get it diagnosed because you want to make sure it is really an allergy to that food before you spend your life avoiding that food, she said. I have known one person who had this allergy, and he suffered a number of allergic reactions. It was a scary time. In early August, Bojangles announced they were now serving a pimento cheese biscuit at selected locations for a limited time, including those in the Triangle. There will be a simple pimento cheese biscuit and a version of the fast food chain's famous Cajun filet biscuit topped with pimento cheese. For the sadly uninitiated, pimento cheese is a kind of tanged up cheddar, usually aided by mayonnaise and a tinge of red peppers. Bojangles takes on this classic southern recipe, can be added to any of its meals or dinners, can get the spread or the restaurant's new pimento cheese biscuit or Cajun-filled biscuit with pimento cheese. Made with three types of cheese, diced tomatoes, creamy mayonnaise, and that one-of-a-kind Bojangles flavor, they said in a statement. The company has put its own unique twist on a quintessential southern classic that's growing in popularity across the country. This spicy spread is perfect complement to Bojangles' beloved classics, the restaurant said. Bojangles used Wilmington as the test market for its pimento cheese experience before launching it to other and southern locations. Bojangles is all about real deal flavor, southern flavor, and pimento cheese is as southern as it gets, Bojangles marketing director Jackie Woodward said. Bojangles has more than 300 locations in North Carolina, including 25 in the Triangle. From 1992 to 1995, Jennifer Randall Collins scored buckets as a starter on the University of South Carolina's women's basketball team. Now her business is pints. The Kentucky native has turned an old family recipe for spiked custard into proof alcoholic ice cream. Eight flavors of real ice cream incorporating moonshine, rum, and, of course, top-shelf Kentucky bourbon. It's an old Kentucky recipe that's been passed around for generations, said Randall Collins, speaking from her and partner Dirk Brown's Licorium Holding Company, located in a suburb of Columbia, South Carolina. But you can't just pour a bottle of booze in a churn and expect to get boozy ice cream, she said. It doesn't work that way. It would separate and be nasty. It all settles to the bottom of the pint, whereas with our product, it's consistent from the first spoonful to the last spoonful, she said. Proof uses a proprietary process for creating the spiked custard base. And while there are many liquor-flavored or low-alcohol-level ice creams in the market, Proof is only one of two brands in the nation to use 80-proof liquor to raise the alcohol by volume rating, or ABV, she said. In the case of Proof, the ABV is 7%, which translates to 14%, about the Gravity Craft beer, Randall Collins said. Her path to alcoholic ice cream CEO was a twisted one. When she graduated a bachelor's degree in business in 1995, she moved back to the Bluegrass State, got married, had a couple of beautiful children, started a political consulting business, and eventually ran across the alcoholic custard recipe. In 2014, Randall Collins entered into a partnership with the Kentucky family that had the recipe, securing the intellectual property rights for the process, and got the company up and running. In 2015, she moved to South Carolina because of regulatory benefits for the product there, a liquor bakery license provision, and partnered with Brown, a serial entrepreneur who is faculty director at the McNair Institute at University of South Carolina's Darla Moore Business School, and set up shop there. I just jumped into my ice cream truck and took samples to restaurants all over South Carolina and got feedback from customers and folks in the back of the house, the employees, she said. Last year, Randall Collins and Brown bought out their Kentucky partners and today distribute to 70 locations all over South Carolina and 20 locations in Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte. In the Triangle, it's available at retailers like Total Wine and More, The Wine Feed, The Butcher's Market and Cary, and other specialty wine shops. My employees and I, mostly me, when we were just getting off the ground, would spend 17 hours a day traveling across South Carolina. To think of the sacrifices we made to get this up and running is just mind-blowing. So is she still driving the truck? I'm not, she said, laughing. At least not every day. I would like to sample some of her products. Speaking of ice cream, we learned that Raleigh's Two Roosters ice cream shop made USA Today's 10 best list of the country's best ice cream shops, joining similarly ambitious ice cream creatives from Oregon to New York City. Flavors like coffee, bourbon, and sea salt chip cookie dough are perennial favorites, and all their ice cream is made using local milk and cream, read the rationale for Two Roosters' inclusion among the best. Two Roosters was started by Jared Plummer as an eye-catching white and teal ice cream trailer showing up at festivals and outside breweries, scooping flavors made from donuts, in-season cobblers, and even bourbon. In 2017, the first Two Roosters shop opened in North Raleigh's Greystone Village, followed by a downtown Raleigh location last year. The USA Today article notes that Two Roosters ice cream collaboration with local chefs include Garland's Cheetah for a Bananas Foster flavor and Snap Pea Underground's Jacob Boehm on a molded chocolate, ginger, and sorghum flavor. Wow! So incredibly honored in USA Today's best 10 best ice cream parlors in America. Two Roosters pointed on its Facebook page. We wouldn't be here where we are today if not for our great staff, our partnering businesses, and outstanding customers. The best is yet to come. Two Roosters also has a location in Durham Bulls Stadium during baseball season and still uses the original pickup truck and trailer. Congratulations. What did you eat for breakfast, or did you eat any breakfast at all? According to a source, 66% of Americans don't eat breakfast at all, at least once a week, even though studies say it's good for our hearts and metabolism. The same source says 64% of us drink a cup of coffee every day. September 29th was National Coffee Day. Many coffee shops, including Starbucks, were offering special rates for coffee on that day. 25% of our daily energy and nutrition needs breakfast should deliver. Cereals aren't the choice they used to be. Cereal consumption is down. Breakfast is being snackified with the handy on-the-go options. Sausage, biscuit, anyone? It's time to share with you another of those food myths. We define a food myth as information that's widely heard and accepted as the truth, when in fact it's not true. And here's the theme. Full-fat dairy products ward off diabetes. Can type 2 diabetes be prevented by cheese? Asked a headline in a Newsweek magazine last year. People who had higher levels of biomarkers of dairy fat had a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes, wrote the article of a recent study. Newsweek reran the article from theconversation.com. But something else about these people could have explained their lower risk. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. And so long until next time.